can rent a device, which makes it,
more affordable,
for many people. But then again, if you have a capnometer yourself, or what we call a capnotrainer, this is really different in a certain way than a capnometer. A capnometer technically is used in medicine, in surgery and critical care, emergency medicine, and so on. But a capnotrainer is used to learn about your breathing. Mm-hmm. How are you breathing? How is it affecting you? What habits do you have? How can you learn new habits? That kind of thing. So you can rent these devices, and you can also buy them. There are different versions of them. There are professional, basic, and personal versions of them. They're all software-based, and you can operate these things on your cell phone and on tablets and, you know, Apple computers, PC computers, whatever, and, you know, really get to know your breathing in detail. Now, we do have a book, by the way.
If I could just interject here about the device. Sure. I don't know the professional ones that have all the computer embedded in the capnometer, but they would be large and clunky and very expensive. But because you're using a different computer, your cell phone or another tablet or a PC or even a desktop, you're able to keep the cost down. And the capnometer that you're describing is just, it's a sensor device. It allows you to input the air into this device, and it will accurately identify that and send that information to the electronic device. So that it keeps the cost down relatively much lower. I mean, how much more would they be if you had to deploy that computer circuitry in the device?
I couldn't guess. I don't really know.
$10,000 probably.
But here's the device. You can see it's very light, very simple. You can put it in a pocket. And you can monitor yourself while you're sleeping. You can monitor yourself when you're doing exercise. You can, check out how you're breathing and, challenging situations where you're concerned that maybe you're getting these strange symptoms and maybe it's because of the way you're breathing. You can check it out. And you can use it in so many different things, whether it's public speaking or whether it's in athletics or, in some professional context, like, as I say, flying an airplane, for example, it becomes very helpful for you to learn about how you breathe, when and where, and how you can essentially bring that online in a way that optimizes your respiration. You don't want to walk around compromised from a respiratory point of view. There's no point to this.
Mm-hmm.
It really needs to be optimal. And,
aside from behavior, there it will definitely seriously impact your biology. Low CO2 numbers are not healthy. It will compromise your mitochondrial function.
Absolutely.
You don't really go into that in your course deeply, but that is an absolute consequence. You do not want to do that. This is something you want to take care of for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's something if you're interested, you can really do it. But, it involves a commitment because it has to do with you being really interested in learning about how you breathe and how it's affecting you. So, what breathing behavior analysts do is they help you do that. Now, you can learn to do it on your own. We actually have a book out that can walk you through that, where you can learn to do it on your own. I mean, you don't have to have some professional to learn about breathing. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. anyone can learn about it. It's yours. I mean, you're doing mm-hmm. it every day, all the time. You don't want to be afraid of it. Oh, my God, I have to talk to an expert to be able to control my respiration. I mean, it's yours. You do what you want with it. So the idea is to try to help you, make sense out of that and, optimize your functioning. And so many people just don't realize that they're breathing dysfunctionally and the symptoms that they have, and they attribute them to all kinds of other things completely unrelated to breathing. And so do the healthcare professionals, because they don't know about it either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're trying to figure out where these symptoms are coming from, but they don't think about the breathing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you mentioned early on, you implied but didn't really go into it, and I want to expand on that now because I think it's an important point, is that your body knows what to do. It absolutely knows what to do. The only time you get into problems with it is when you usually subconsciously override it.
Right, with these unconsciously override it. It happens constantly.
Yeah, would be more accurate.
Yeah.
So that's the trick. That's the trick. Since I've taken your course in the last dialogue with you, I've engaged in another study deeply, very deeply. And one of the core tenets of this study, which is more about consciousness training, is that you the one of the core tenets is to trust yourself. Trust yourself. Your
That's
body
key,
knows the
key,
answer. That
key.
is so fundamental to everything, not just
Right.
raised life and everything. I mean,
And
that is
it can generalize by metaphor to other things. If you can learn to trust that breathing, that it's
right.
going to happen, you don't have to do it. It has a huge impact on people. I've
Yeah.
seen it over the years. It's amazing.
And I'm confident that's one of the reasons why you're so successful at what you do, because that is a core tenet of life. And you're teaching that and it's changing people's lives because you understand that. Yeah. So congratulations.
That's totally fundamental. That's what we work on, is helping people build trust in that system. And that's what I was talking about at the very beginning about partnering with your body. That partnership is vital. And so you're not a victim of your body. You're in the body. This is who you are. And it is. You own this. You own your breathing. You're not a victim of your breathing, and that's often a problem. People think they're a victim of all of this.
Yeah, and I personally, I just want to share my experience with using the capnometer because I had a really nasty breathing habit most of my adult life, almost my entire adult life. And I don't know how I picked it up, but and I'm assuming it did in the past because of what happened. But essentially, when I exercise a lot. I've been exercising since 1968. That's 55 years, I think, close to it, and. When I would exercise, I would overbreathe, which I think is common, but I certainly it was happening
Very
for me.
common,
Yeah,
very
and
common.
so why should I be any different? And when I would measure it when I was working out, I would get hypocapnic big time. Now I probably adjusted to the symptoms to that condition, so I didn't have any significant symptoms. I wasn't impaired in any way, other than my physiology was going south because my CO2 levels were too low. So. Having that device and using it while I'm working out and monitoring my CO2 levels in real time allowed me to learn how to modulate my breathing. Now I don't need it because I've gone through the experience. And you don't have to wear the sensor the rest of your life. You
Right,
just
right.
need to understand the process, and then your body becomes retrained to a new pattern.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, and a lot of times, people, these breathing techniques that are out there generally just don't address habits. And they may by accident address a habit and then give credit to the technique somehow, rather than understanding it's about some kind of embedded learning that has occurred in the process, that fear had was addressed. But they may think, well, it's the slowness of breathing. Breathing slow is really good, and so it's parasympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system, and that's why it worked. When in reality, what it was about was that you lost your fear associated with the end of the exhale, for example, because of the technique they were using. But people aren't focusing on it that way. It's all physical. They aren't looking at the experiential side of it, which is key to understanding breathing behavior.
And you had mentioned that this world-class breathing expert actually was going to the emergency room every month. But there are, yeah, I just, I am not unfairly criticizing this technique because I've endorsed it and I've interviewed experts in the field on it. It's Buteyko breathing, which is generally regarded as one of the better approaches to this type of breathing technique that you have mentioned. But you shared in your course many examples of really skilled Buteyko practitioners that was their full-time job, who had serious dysfunctional breathing by themselves.
Correct.
So why don't you elaborate on that? Because I think that's an interesting
Sure.
point.
Well,
Because
because you see
we're
the,
not picking on
yeah.
Buteyko. They're almost every breathing technique has this as a consequence of because they're not addressing the behavior.
They're not addressing the behavior, they're not addressing the habits. If you don't address the habits, they're still there. They don't just disappear because you do something else. So when you look at Buteyko, and Buteyko can be very helpful to people. I don't have any doubt about that. But first of all, Buteyko really addresses people who chronically overbreathe or have chronic hypocapnia, where they breathe that way all day long, So they habituate to a lower level of carbon dioxide. So when you raise the carbon dioxide level, people get uncomfortable. You try to bring it up to normal, and they get very uncomfortable. They're not happy. And so Buteyko addresses that, okay? But most people with breathing problems do not have chronic hypocapnia. Most of them have acute hypocapnia, like those ambulance runs. Those aren't people who are over-breathing all day long. Those are people who suddenly overbreathe and they have these wild symptoms and they call for an ambulance. So most issues around breathing when it comes to hypocapnia are acute. It isn't chronic. So the first thing is that Buteyko is really limited to that. And secondly, you have to ask yourself the question, if you're a Buteyko worker, which generally doesn't seem to happen in my experience, is where did that hypocapnia come from in the first place? Why is this person breathing like that you now have to train them to habituate to a higher level of CO2? How did that happen? What's the history of that? Okay, and if the history is that this is a way I can control, my wife, like I was talking about that school teacher who felt like beating her partner over the head. If that's what, you're overventilating so you can get angry to control your environment, what good is Buteyko going to do? That person isn't going to raise their CO2 level. They want it down so they can get angry. So you have to address the motivation behind the behavior and what the outcomes are that sustain it. Just because you can habituate to a higher level of CO2 doesn't mean you've addressed the problem. The problem is the habit. And so it glosses over that so that you don't get to that. That's a really important consideration. You want to identify the habit, help the person through it, help them understand where it came from and what they can do now about it. And that may have a significant philosophical impact on them as well, on their belief system about their physiology, the trust, as we were talking about earlier, in their system and so on. So, it's limited because you're not addressing history of the breathing, you're not addressing any of these various factors that we've been talking about. You're just looking at the CO2 level. My God, it's too low. We need to raise it. But another problem with Buteyko is that they don't measure it.
Yes.
They don't
Well,
measure
some
it. So
do,
do you,
but it's not part of their core
right.
curriculum.
But some do, like people we've trained do. Well, we have a lot of people who graduated from our program who are Buteyko workers, and they measure it. And so you can measure it. And then when you think you've been successful with your client, you need to see that the CO2 went up. If it didn't go up, still down, you weren't successful. So it's very important to be able to assess it right from the start. Because when you do Buteyko, when they do their testing, they're looking at correlational findings. You look at this Bolt test they have. It's really about, if people are a certain way, they're more likely to be suffering with hypocapnia than if they're another way. Okay, so it's just a correlation. It doesn't mean you're overbreathing. It means there's a significant chance that maybe you're overbreathing. So you're not really measuring any physiology. You're not really looking at any behavior or anything like that. So it's just this technique where you try to build up this tolerance, as they call it. I don't call it tolerance. It's about habituating to a higher level. That's a physiological process. Habituation, there are hundreds, thousands of articles on habituation. It's a well-known phenomenon. It's not just about CO2. It's about all kinds of things. So, but on the other hand, they really do a great job because, when people get into that transition time that's extended, they get comfortable with allowing the breath to sit out there for long periods of time so they can build trust when they do
That's
that. And they
key.
may find the reflex in it because it's identifying the reflexes what ultimately really builds trust because you can feel it kick in. You can find that reflex, then you've won a significant part of the battle. And there's a good chance that can happen because of what the Buteyko people do. And you can desensitize the anxiety and the air hunger can dissipate by doing that. So that's helpful.
And they teach you to listen to your body, which is just an absolutely exceptional skill, and that sadly most people never are able to. achieve. But if you can put direct your efforts and make that as goals to really pay attention to what your body's telling you and learn to trust it, it's designed to make you better. And if you ignore it, you're just asking for trouble. You're just asking for trouble. So I want to expand a bit on the hospital runs because you mentioned it, but I think many people just may gloss over them. 60%. Now, what I want to emphasize is that when you pick up the phone and call 911, most people aren't going to want to do that because they know the consequences. Right. Of
most
that.
People aren't.
The consequences of that could be medical bankruptcy. It's the most common cause of bankruptcy in the United States because you could get a bill for $2, $10, $20, $50,000 for picking up that phone. $50,000 for an ambulance run. So you are not going to do it unless you think you are dying. I mean, these people are severely handicapped. There's no way they're going to pay $50,000 if they didn't think they were dying. Most of them, not some of them. I mean, not every one of them, but almost all of them, I'm sure. So this is a serious, serious problem. It's more than half of the ambulance runs are due to this problem. So this is screaming that this is a huge issue that's pervasive in our population. And
it's
virtually
just a tip
no
of the
understanding. Yeah, it's a tip. Yeah, almost everyone has it. I had it.
Right. It's just, and you know, you can take it to so many places. I mean, it's a huge iceberg underneath that. So few people, as you say, are going to call 911. It's a very embarrassing thing to do aside from it's being expensive. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
They don't want to do it. So yeah, it's,